sat down and got a bruising bear hug from Franco, who had slightly outmaneuvered Nino as the bodyguard. Sam outlined the practice plan, and the speeches were over. With a rousing cheer, they hustled from the locker room and over to the practice field, where they fanned out into a somewhat organized pattern and began stretching. At this point, a thick-necked gentleman with a shaved head and bulging biceps took over. He was Alex Olivetto, a former player, now an assistant coach, and a real Italian. He strutted up and down the lines of players, barking orders like an angry field marshal, and there was no backtalk. "He's psycho," Sly said when Alex was far away. Rick was at the end of a line, next to Sly and behind Trey, copying the stretches and exercises of his teammates. Alex went from the basics, jumping jacks, push-ups, sit-ups, lunges, to a grueling session of running in place, with an occasional drop to the ground, then back up. After 15 minutes, Rick was heaving and trying to forget last night's dinner. He glanced to his left and noticed that Nino had worked up a good sweat. After 30 minutes, Rick was sorely tempted to pull Sam aside and explain a few things. He was the quarterback, you know, and quarterbacks at the professional level are not subjected to the same drills and boot camp banalities required of the regular players. But Sam was far away, at the other end of the field. Then Rick realized he was being watched. As the warm-up dragged on, he caught more glances from his teammates, just checking to see if a real pro quarterback could grind it out with them. Was he a member of the team, or a prima donna, just passing through? Rick kicked it up a notch to impress them. Usually, wind sprints were put off until the end of practice, but not so with Alex. After 45 minutes of bruising exercises, the team members gathered at the goal line and in groups of six sprinted 40 yards downfield, where Alex was waiting with a very active whistle and a nasty insult for whoever brought up the rear. Rick ran with the backs. Sly easily raced away, and Franco easily thundered in last. Rick was in the middle, and as he sprinted, he remembered the glory days at Davenport South when he ran wild and scored almost as many touchdowns with his feet as with his arm. The running slowed considerably in college. He was simply not a running quarterback. Running was almost prohibited in the pros. It was an excellent way to get a leg broken. The Italians chattered at each other, offering encouragement as the sprints dragged on. After five, they were breathing heavily, and Alex was just warming up.
"Can you puke?" Sly asked between breaths.
"Why?"
"Because he runs us until someone pukes."
"Go ahead."
"I wish I could."
After 10:40s, Rick was asking himself what exactly he had been expecting in Parma. His hamstrings were on fire. His calves ached. He was straining and gasping and soaked with sweat, though the temperature was hardly warm. He'd have a talk with Sam and get some things straight. This wasn't high school ball. He was a pro. Nino bolted for the sideline, ripped off his helmet, and delivered. The team yelled its encouragement, and Alex gave three quick bursts on the whistle. After a water break, Sam stepped forward with instructions. He would take the backs and receivers. Nino had the offensive linemen. Alex had the linebackers and defensive linemen. Trey was in charge of the secondary. They scattered around the field.
"This is Fabrizio," Sam said, introducing the rather slim receiver to Rick. "Our wideout. Great hands."
They acknowledged each other. High maintenance, high strung, God's gift to Italian football. Sam had briefed Rick on Fabrizio and suggested that he take it easy on the kid for the first couple of days. There had been no small number of receivers in the NFL who'd had trouble with Rick's bullets, at least in practice. In games, the bullets, though beautiful, had too often sailed high and wide. A few had been caught by fans five rows up. The backup quarterback was a 20-year-old Italian named Alberto something or other. Rick threw soft sideline routes to one group, Alberto to the other. According to Sam, Alberto preferred to run the ball because he had a rather weak arm. Weak it was, Rick noticed after a couple of passes. He threw like a shot putter, and his passes fluttered through the air like wounded birds.
"Was he the backup last year?" Rick asked when Sam got close enough.
"Yes, but didn't play much."
Fabrizio was a natural athlete, quick and graceful, with soft hands. He worked hard to appear nonchalant, as if anything Rick fired to him was just another easy catch. He big-leagued a few catches, snared them with too much cocky indifference, then committed a sin that would have cost him dearly in the NFL. On a lackadaisical quick-out,
He snatched the ball with one hand simply to show off. The pass was on target and did not need a one-arm grab. Rick simmered, but Sam was all over it. "Let it go," he said. "He doesn't know any better." Rick's arm was still slightly sore, and though he was in no hurry to impress anyone, he was tempted to gun one into Fabrizio's chest and watch him drop like a rock. "Relax," he said to himself. "He's just a kid having fun." Then Sam barked at Fabrizio for running sloppy patterns, and the kid sulked like a baby. More patterns, longer throws. Then Sam brought the offense together for a review of the basics. Nino squatted over the ball, and to prevent jammed fingers, Rick suggested they practice a few snaps, slowly. Nino agreed that this was an excellent idea, but when Rick's hands touched his backside, he flinched. Not a radical jerk of the rear, nothing that would cause a referee to flag him for illegal procedure or offside, but a distinguishable tightening of the gluteus maximus, much like a school kid about to receive licks from a thick wooden paddle. Perhaps it was just a case of new quarterback jitters, Rick told himself. For the next snap, Nino hovered over the ball. Rick bent slightly forward, eased his hands just under the center's rump, as he had done since junior high school, and upon contact, Nino's glutes instinctively tightened again. The snaps were slow and soft, and Rick knew immediately that hours were needed to improve Nino's technique. A full step would be wasted waiting on the ball while tailbacks broke for their holes and receivers ran to their spots. On the third snap, Rick's fingers grazed Nino's zone ever so slightly, and evidently, such a soft touch was far worse than an outright slap with the hands. Both cheeks arched painfully at the delicate contact. Rick glanced at Sam and quickly said, "Can you tell him to relax his ass?" Sam turned away to keep from laughing.
"His problem?" Nino asked.
"Never mind," Rick said. Sam blew his whistle, called a play in English, then Italian. It was a simple tailback off tackle to the right, Sly taking the handoff with Franco plowing through the hole first like a bulldozer. "The cadence?" Rick asked as the lineman settled into place. "Down set hut," Sam replied, "in English." Nino, who evidently held the unofficial position of offensive line coach, inspected the guards and tackles before squatting over the ball and preparing his glutes. Rick touched them as he yelled, "Down!" They flinched, and Rick hurriedly added, "Set!" Then, "Hut!" Franco grunted like a bear as he lunged from his three-point stance and lurched to the right. The line moved forward, bodies jolting upright, voices growling as if the hated Bergamo Lions were over there, and Rick waited an eternity for the ball to arrive from his center. He was half a step back when he finally grabbed it, turned, and thrust it at Sly, who had already run up the back of Franco. Sam blew his whistle, yelled something in Italian, then, "Do it again!" And again, and again. After 10 snaps, Alberto stepped in to run the offense, and Rick found some water. He sat on his helmet and was soon drifting away to other teams, other fields. The drudgery of practice was the same everywhere, he decided. From Iowa to Canada to Parma, and all those stops in between, the worst part of the game, in whatever language, was the numbing tedium of physical conditioning and the repetition of running play after play. It was late when Alex assumed authority again, and with his quick, shrill whistle, the 40-yard sprints began with a fury. The jokes and insults were gone. No one laughed or yelled as they ran down the field, slower with each whistle, but not so slow that Alex might get upset. After each sprint, they trotted back to the goal line, rested for a few seconds, then off again. Rick vowed to have a serious little chat with the head coach tomorrow. "Real quarterbacks do not run wind sprints," he kept telling himself as he urged himself to get sick. The Panthers had a delightful post-practice ritual. A late dinner of pizza and beer at Polipo's, a small restaurant on Via La Spezia, on the edge of the city. By 11:30, most of the team had arrived, fresh from showers and anxious to officially kick off another season. Gianni, the owner, put them in a back corner so they wouldn't be too disruptive. They gathered around two long tables and all talked at once. Just minutes after they settled in, two waiters brought pitchers of beer and mugs, quickly followed by more waiters with the largest pizzas Rick had ever seen. He was at one end, with Sam on one side and Sly on the other. Nino rose to make a toast, first in rapid Italian, and everyone looked at Rick, then in slightly slower English. "Welcome to our little town, Mr. Rick. We hope
You'll find a home here and bring us a Super Bowl.
An odd round of hollering followed, and they drained their glasses. Sam explained that Signor Bruncardo picked up the tab for these rather boisterous dinners and treated the team at least once a week after practice. Pizza and pasta, some of the best spaghetti in town, without all the fuss and ceremony that Nino so fondly dispensed at Montana's. Cheap food, but delicious. Judge Franco stood with a fresh glass and launched into a windy speech about something.
More of the same, Sam mumbled in English. A toast to a great season, brotherhood, no injuries, etc., and of course to the great new quarterback.
It was obvious Franco would not allow himself to be outdone by Nino. After they drank and cheered some more, Sam said, "Those two jockey for attention. They're permanent co-captains."
"Picked by the team?"
"I suppose, but I've never seen an election, and this is my sixth season. It's their team, basically. They keep the boys motivated in the off-season. They're always recruiting new locals to take up the sport, especially ex-soccer players who've lost a step. They'll convert a rugby player every now and then. They yell and scream before the game, and some of their halftime tongue lashings are beautiful. In the heat of battle, you want them in your foxhole." The beer flowed and the pizza disappeared. Nino called for order and introduced two new members of the team. Carl was a Danish math professor who'd settled in Parma with his Italian wife and taught at the university. He wasn't sure what position he might play, but was anxious to select one. Pietro was a baby-faced fireplug, short and thick, a linebacker. Rick had noticed his quick feet in practice. Franco led them in some mournful chant that not even Sam understood. Then they burst into laughter and grabbed the beer pitchers. Waves of clamorous Italian rattled around the room, and after a few beers, Rick was content to just sit and absorb the scene. He was an extra in a foreign film. Shortly before midnight, Rick plugged in his laptop and emailed Arnie. "In Parma. Arrived late yesterday. First practice today. Food and wine are worth the visit. No cheerleaders, Arnie. You promised me beautiful cheerleaders. No agents here, so you'd hate the place. No golf anywhere, yet. Any word from Tiffany and her lawyers? I remember Jason Cosgrove talking about her in the shower with details, and he made $8 million last year. Sick the lawyers on him. I ain't the daddy. Even the little kids speak Italian over here. Why am I in Parma? Could be worse, I guess. Could be in Cleveland. Later. R.D. While Rick was asleep, Arnie returned the message. "Rick, great to hear from you. Delighted you're there and enjoying yourself. Treat it as an adventure. Not much happening here. No word from the lawyers. I'll suggest Cosgrove as the sperm donor. She's 7 months along now. I know you hate the arena game, but a GM called today and said he might get you $50,000 for next season. I said no. What about it?"
Chapter 10.
Waking at such a dreadful hour could only be accomplished with the aid of an alarm clock set at a high volume. The steady, piercing beep penetrated the darkness and finally found its mark. Rick, who seldom used an alarm and had developed the pleasant routine of waking whenever his body was tired of sleep, flopped around under the sheets until he found an off switch. In the shock of the moment, he thought of Officer Romo and was horrified of another non-arrest. Then he shook off the cobwebs in wild thoughts. As his heart rate began a gradual decline and he propped himself up on the pillows, he finally remembered why he'd set the alarm in the first place. He had a plan, and darkness was a crucial element. Since his off-season regimen had been nothing but golf, both legs felt broken to bits and his abs ached as if he'd been punched repeatedly. His arms, shoulders, back, even ankles and toes were sore to the touch. He cursed Alex and Sam and the entire Panther organization, if it could be called that. He cursed football and Arnie, and beginning with the Browns, every team in reverse order that had given him the pink slip. As he conjured up vile thoughts about the game, he tried carefully to stretch a muscle or two, but the muscles were simply too sore. Fortunately, he had laid off the beer at Pilippo's, or at least he had stopped at a reasonable limit. His head was clearing, with no signs of a hangover. If he could hurry and complete his mission as planned, he might be back under the covers in an hour or so. He passed on a shower. The pressure was startlingly weak and the hot water only passably lukewarm. And, forcing each movement with a grim determination, was outside on the street in less than 10 minutes. Walking loosened the joints and circulated the blood,
and after two blocks he was moving briskly and feeling much better. The Fiat was 5 minutes away. He stood on the sidewalk staring at it. The narrow street was lined on both sides by compact cars parked bumper to bumper, leaving between them a single lane of traffic headed north to the center of Parma. The street was dark, quiet, empty of traffic. Behind the Fiat was a lime green smart car, a model slightly larger than a decent-sized go-kart, and its front bumper was about 10 inches from Signor Bruncardo's Fiat. To the front was a white Citroen, not much larger than the smart car, and wedged in just as tightly. Dislodging the Fiat would be a challenge, even for a driver with years of stick-shift experience. A quick glance right and left to make sure no one was stirring on Via Antini, then Rick unlocked the car and crawled in as sharp pains shot through his joints. He wiggled the stick to make sure it was in neutral, tried to unfold his legs, checked the parking brake, then started the engine. Lights on, gauges up, plenty of fuel. Where was the heater? He adjusted mirrors, the seat belt, and for a good 5 minutes went through the pre-flight as the Fiat warmed itself. Not a single car, scooter, or bike passed him on the street. Once the windshield was defrosted, there was no reason for further delays. His rising heart rate angered him, but he tried to ignore it. This was just a car with a clutch, and not even his car at that. He released the parking brake, held his breath, and nothing happened. Via Antini happens to be quite flat. Foot on clutch, ease into first, a touch of accelerator, turn the wheel hard to the right, so far so good, a check of the mirror, no traffic, let's go. Rick eased off the clutch and gave it some gas, but gave it too much. The engine growled, he let off the clutch, and the Fiat lurched forward and bumped the Citroen just as he slammed the brake. Red gauge lights lit up the dash, and it took a few seconds to realize the car had died. He quickly turned the key while shifting into reverse and pressing the clutch and pulling on the parking brake and cursing under his breath while glancing over his shoulder at the street. No one was coming. No one was watching. The trip in reverse was as rough as the one forward, and when he tapped the smart car, he hit the brake again and the engine died. Now he cursed loudly, no effort to keep the language under control. He took a deep breath and decided not to inspect the damage. There really wasn't any, he decided. Just a little nudge. Damn guy deserved it for parking on top of the Fiat. His hands moved quickly. Steering, ignition, stick, parking brake. Why was he using the brake? His feet were all over the place, tap dancing wildly from clutch to brake to gas. He roared forward again, barely nicking the Citroen before stopping, but this time the engine did not die. Progress. The Fiat was halfway in the street, still no traffic. Quickly into reverse again, but a bit too quickly, and he lurched back, his head snapping and sore muscles aching. He hit the smart car much harder the second time, and the Fiat was dead. His language was out of control as he again glanced around looking for spectators. She just appeared. He hadn't noticed her walking down the sidewalk. She stood there as if she'd been standing for hours, her body draped in a long wool overcoat, her head wrapped in a yellow shawl. An old woman with an old dog on a leash, out for the morning stroll, and now stopped dead by the violent pinball action of a copper-colored Fiat driven by an idiot. Their eyes met. Her scowl and heavily wrinkled face conveyed exactly what she was thinking. Rick's wild desperation was quite evident. He stopped cursing for a second. The dog was staring, too, some type of frail terrier with a look as perplexed as the master's. It took a second for Rick to realize she was not the owner of either of the cars he was pounding. Of course she wasn't. She was a pedestrian. And before she could call the cops, if she were so inclined, he'd be gone. He hoped. Anyway, he started to say something like, "What the hell are you looking at?" But then she wouldn't understand, and she would probably realize he was an American. A sudden patriotism sealed his lips. With the front of the car jutting into the street, he had no time for a stare down. He jerked his head arrogantly back to the matters at hand, reshifting and restarting and urging himself to work the gas and clutch with perfect coordination so the Fiat could finally roll away and be gone, leaving his audience behind. He pressed the gas hard, the engine strained again, and he slowly released the clutch as he turned the wheel hard and barely missed the Citroen. Free at last, He was rolling now, along Via Antini, the Fiat still in first and straining mightily. He made the mistake of one last triumphant look at the woman and the dog. He saw her brown teeth. She was laughing at him. The dog was barking and pulling on the leash, also amused. Rick had memorized the streets along his escape route. No small feat, since many were narrow, one-way, and often confusing. He worked his way south, shifting only when necessary, and soon hit Viale Bernini, a major street with a few cars and delivery trucks moving about. He stopped at a red light, shifted into first, and prayed no one would stop behind him. He waited for the green, then lurched forward without killing the engine. Attaboy. He was surviving. He crossed the Parma River on the Ponte Italia, and a quick glance revealed quiet waters below. He was away from downtown now, and there was even less traffic. The target was Viale Vittoria, a wide, sweeping, four-lane avenue that circled the west side of Parma. Very flat and almost deserted in the pre-dawn darkness. Perfect for practice. For an hour, as day broke over the city, Rick drove up and down the wonderfully level street. The clutch was dragging a bit halfway down, and this slight problem captured his attention. However, after an hour of diligent work, he was gaining confidence, and he and the Fiat were becoming one. Sleep was no longer an option. He was far too impressed with his new talent. In a wide median, he practiced parking within the yellow lines, back and forth, until he grew bored. He was quite confident now, and he noticed a bar near Piazza Santa Croce. Why not? He was feeling more Italian by the minute, and he needed caffeine. He parked again, turned off the engine, and enjoyed a brisk walk. The streets were busy now. The city had come to life. The bar was full and noisy, and his first inclination was to make a quick exit and return to the safety of his Fiat. But no, he had signed on for 5 months, and he would not spend that time on the run. He walked to a bar, caught the attention of a barista, and said, "Espresso?" The barista nodded to a corner where a plump lady sat behind a cash register. The barista had no interest in making an espresso for Rick, who retreated a step and again thought about fleeing. A well-dressed businessman entered in a rush, holding at least two newspapers and a briefcase, and walked directly to the cashier. "Buongiorno," he said, and she offered the same. "Caffè," he said as he pulled out a 5-euro note. She took it, made change, and handed him a receipt. He took the receipt directly to the counter and laid it where one of the baristas could plainly see it. A barista finally took it, they exchanged buongiornos, and everything worked fine. Within seconds, a small cup and saucer landed on the counter, and the businessman, already deep in front-page news, added sugar, stirred, then demolished the drink in one long gulp. So that's how you do it. Rick walked to the cashier, mumbled a passable buongiorno, and flung over a 5-euro note of his own before the lady could respond. She made change and handed him a magical receipt. As he stood at the counter and sipped his coffee, he absorbed the frenzy of the bar. Most of the people were on their way to work, and they seemed to know one another. Some talked nonstop, while others were buried in newspapers. The baristas worked feverishly, but never wasted a step. They bantered in rapid Italian and were quick to return quips from their customers. Away from the counters, there were tables where waiters in white aprons delivered coffee and bottled water and all manner of pastries. Rick was suddenly hungry, in spite of the truckload of carbs he had consumed just a few hours earlier at Polipo's. A shelf of sweet rolls caught his attention, and he desperately wanted one covered with chocolate and cream. But how to get it? He wouldn't dare open his mouth, not with so many people within earshot. Perhaps the cashier in the corner would be sympathetic to an American who could only point. He left the bar hungry. He walked along Viale Vittoria, then ventured down a side street, looking for nothing but enjoying the sights. Another bar beckoned. He walked in with confidence, went straight to the cashier, another hefty old woman, and said, "Buongiorno. Cappuccino, please?" She couldn't have cared less where he was from, and her indifference encouraged him. He pointed to a thick pastry on a rack by the counter and said, "And one of these?" She nodded again as he handed over a 10-euro note, certainly enough to cover coffee and a croissant. The bar was less crowded than the other one, and Rick savored the cornetto and cappuccino. It was called Bar Bruno, and whoever Bruno was, he certainly loved his soccer. The walls were covered with team posters and action shots and schedules that dated back 30 years. There was a banner from the World Cup victory in 1982. Above the cashier, Bruno had nailed a collection of enlarged black and whites. Bruno with Cinaglia. Bruno hugging Baggio. Rick assumed that he would be hard-pressed to find a bar or cafe in Parma with a single photo of the Panthers. Oh well, this ain't Pittsburgh. The Fiat was exactly where he'd left it. The jolts of caffeine had raised his confidence. He eased perfectly into reverse, then pulled away smoothly as if he'd worked a clutch for years. The challenge of Central Parma was daunting, but he had no choice. Sooner or later, he had to go home and take his Fiat with him. At first glance, the police car did not alarm him. It was following at a benign pace. Rick stopped at a red light and waited patiently while mentally working the clutch and accelerator. The light turned green, the clutch slipped, the Fiat lunged, then died. Frantically, he reshifted as he turned the key and cursed and kept one eye on the police. The black and white cruiser was on his rear bumper, and the two young cops were frowning. What the hell? Something wrong back there? His second attempt was worse than the first, and when the Fiat died another quick death, the police suddenly laid on the horn. Finally, the engine caught. He hit the gas and barely released the clutch, and the Fiat rolled forward, roaring in such a low gear but hardly moving. The police followed tightly, probably amused at the bucking and lunging ahead of them. After a block, they turned on the blue lights. Rick managed to pull over in a loading zone in front of a row of shops. He turned the ignition off, pulled hard on the parking brake, then instinctively reached for the glove box. He had given no thought to Italian laws governing vehicle registration or driving privileges, nor had he assumed that the Panthers and specifically Signor Brancardo would handle such matters. He had assumed nothing, thought of nothing, worried about nothing. He was a professional athlete who was once a high school and college star, and from that lofty perch, small details had never mattered. The glove box was empty. A cop was tapping on his window, and he rolled it down. No power windows. The cop said something, and Rick caught the word, "Documenti." He snatched his wallet and thrust out his Iowa driver's license. Iowa? He hadn't lived in Iowa in 6 years. But then, he hadn't established a home anywhere else. As the cop frowned at the plastic card, Rick sunk a few inches lower as he remembered a phone call from his mother before Christmas. She had just received a notice from the state. His license had expired.
"Americano," the officer said.
His tone was accusatory. His name badge declared him to be ASCII.
"Yes,"
Rick replied, though he could have handled a quick C. He did not, because even the slightest use of Italian prompted the speaker on the other end to assume the foreigner was fluent. ASCII opened the door and motioned for Rick to get out. The other officer, Dini, strutted up with a sneer, and they launched into a quick round of Italian. From their looks, Rick thought he might be beaten on the spot. They were in their early 20s, tall and built like weightlifters. They could play defense for the Panthers. An elderly couple stopped on the sidewalk to witness the drama from 10 feet away.
"Speak Italian?" Dini asked.
"No, sorry." Both rolled their eyes. A moron.
They separated and began a dramatic inspection of the crime scene. They studied the front license plates, then the rear. The glove box was opened carefully, as if it might just hold a bomb. Then the trunk. Rick grew bored with it and leaned against the left front fender. They huddled, consulted, and radioed headquarters. Then the inevitable paperwork began, with both officers scribbling furiously. Rick was very curious about his crime. He was certain that registration laws had been broken, but he would plead not guilty to any moving violation. He thought about calling Sam, but his cell phone was next to his bed. When he saw the tow truck, he almost laughed. After the Fiat disappeared, Rick was put into the rear seat of the police car and driven away. No handcuffs, no threats, everything nice and civilized. As they crossed the river, he remembered something in his wallet. He pulled out a business card he had taken from Franco's office and handed it to Dini in the front seat.
"My friend," he said.
"Giuseppe Lazzarino. Giudice."
Both cops seemed to know Judge Lazzarino quite well. Their tone, demeanor, and body language changed. Both talked at once in muffled voices, as if they didn't want their prisoner to hear. ASCII sighed heavily as Dini's shoulders sagged. Across the river, they changed directions and for a few minutes seemed to go in circles. ASCII called someone on the radio but did not find whomever or whatever he wanted. Dini used his cell phone, but he, too, was disappointed. Rick sat low in the rear seat, laughing at himself and trying to enjoy the tour of Parma. They parked him on the bench outside Franco's office, the same spot Romo had selected about 24 hours earlier. Dini reluctantly went inside, while Askey found a spot 20 feet down the hall, as if he had nothing to do with Rick. They waited as the minutes dragged by. Rick was curious as to whether this qualified as a real arrest or one of the Romo variety. How was one supposed to know? One more altercation with the police, and the Panthers, and Sam Russo, and Signor Bruncardo, and his paltry contract could all take a hike. He almost missed Cleveland. Loud voices, then the door swung open as his fullback charged through, Dini in tow. Askey bolted to attention.
Rick, I am so sorry,
Franco thundered as he yanked him from the bench and smothered him with a bear hug.
I'm so sorry. There is a mistake, no?
The judge glared at Dini, who was studying his very shiny black boots, and looked somewhat pale. Askey was a deer in headlights. Rick tried to say something, but words failed him. In the doorway, Franco's cute secretary watched the encounter. Franco unloaded a few words at Askey, then a sharp question for Dini, who tried to answer, but thought better of it. Back to Rick.
Is no problem, okay?
Fine, Rick said. It's okay.
The car. It is not yours.
No, I think Signor Broncardo owns it. Franco's eyes widened and his spine stiffened.
Broncardo's.
Both Askey and Dini partially collapsed at the news. They stayed on their feet but couldn't breathe. Franco shot some harsh Italian at them, and Rick caught at least two Broncardos. Two gentlemen, who appeared to be lawyers, dark suits, thick briefcases, important airs, approached. For their benefit, and Rick's and his staff's, Judge Lazzarino proceeded to blister the two young cops with the fervor of an angry drill sergeant. Rick immediately felt sorry for them. After all, they had treated him with more respect than a common street criminal could expect. When the tongue-lashing was over, Askey and Dini scattered, never to be seen again. Franco explained that the car was being retrieved that very moment and would be returned to Rick immediately. No need to tell Signor Broncardo. More apologies. The two lawyers finally drifted into the judge's office, and the secretaries returned to work. Franco apologized again, and, to show his sincere regret at the way Rick had been welcomed in Parma, he insisted on dinner the following night at his home. His wife, very pretty, he said, was an excellent cook. He would not take no for an answer. Rick accepted the invitation, and Franco then explained that he had an important meeting with some lawyers. They would see each other at dinner. Farewell. Ciao. Chapter 11. The team trainer was a wiry, wild-eyed college boy named Matteo, who spoke terrible English and spoke it rapidly. After several efforts, he finally made his point. He wanted to give their great new quarterback a rubdown. He was studying something that had something else to do with a new theory of massage. Rick desperately needed a rubdown. He stretched out on one of the two training tables and told Matteo to have a go. After a few seconds, the kid was hacking at his hamstrings and Rick wanted to scream. But you can't complain during a massage. It was a rule that had never been violated in the history of professional football. Regardless of how much things might hurt, big, tough footballers do not complain during rubdowns.
"He's good," Matteo said between breaths.
"Yes, slow down."
It didn't survive the translation, and Rick buried his face in a towel. They were in the locker room, which doubled as the equipment room and tripled as the coaches' offices. No one else was present. Practice was 4 hours away. As Matteo pounded furiously, Rick managed to drift away from the assault. He wrestled with the proper approach to suggest to Coach Russo that he preferred not to suffer through the conditioning drills anymore. No more wind sprints, push-ups, or sit-ups. He was in good shape, at least good enough for what was ahead. Too much running might injure a leg, pull a muscle, or something of that nature. In most pro camps, the quarterbacks handled their own stretching and warm-ups and had their own little routines while everyone else grunted it out. However, he was also fretting about how it would look to the team. Spoiled American quarterback. Too good for drills, too soft for a little conditioning. The Italians seemed to thrive on dirt and sweat, and full pads were 3 days away. Matteo settled onto his lower back and calmed down. The massage was working. The stiff, sore muscles were relaxing. Sam appeared and took a seat on the other training table.
I thought you were in shape, he began pleasantly.
I thought I was too.
With an audience, Mateo returned to his jackhammer method.
Pretty sore, huh?
A little.
I don't normally run too many wind sprints.
Get used to it. If you slack off, the Italians will think you're just a pretty boy.
That settled that.
I'm not the one who puked.
No, but you sure looked like it.
Thanks.
Just got a call from Franco. More trouble with the police, huh? You all right?
As long as I got Franco, the cops can arrest me for nothing every day.
He was sweating now from the pain and trying to appear nonchalant.
We'll get you a temporary license and some paperwork for the car. My mistake. Sorry about it.
No sweat. Franco's got some cute secretaries.
Wait till you see his wife.
He included us for dinner tomorrow night, me and Anna.
Great.
Mateo flipped him over and began pinching his thighs. Rick almost screamed, but managed to keep a straight face.
Can we talk about the offense? Rick asked.
You've gone through the playbook?
It's high school stuff.
Yeah, it's very basic. We can't get too fancy here. The players have limited experience, and there's not much practice time.
No complaints. I just have a few ideas.
Let's go.
Mateo backed away like a proud surgeon, and Rick thanked him.
Very nice job, he said, limping away.
Sly came bouncing in with wires running from his ears, trucker's cap cocked to one side, and again wearing the Broncos sweatshirt.
Hey, Sly, how about a great massage over here? Rick yelled. Mateo's wonderful.
They exchanged jabs, Broncos versus Browns and so on, as Sly stripped to his boxers and stretched out on the table. Mateo cracked his knuckles, then plunged in. Sly grimaced, but bit his tongue. 2 hours before practice, Rick, Sly, and Trey Colby were on the field with Coach Russo, walking through the offensive plays. To Sam's relief, his new quarterback had no interest in changing everything. Rick made suggestions here and there, tweaked some of the pass routes, and offered ideas about the running game. Sly reminded him more than once that the Panthers' running game was quite simple. Just give the ball to Sly and get out of the way. Fabrizio appeared at the far end of the field, alone and determined to keep to himself. He began an elaborate stretching routine, one designed more for show than to loosen tight muscles.
Well, he's back for the second day, Sly said as they watched him for a moment.
What does that mean? Rick asked.
He hasn't quit yet, Trey said.
Quit?
Yeah, he has the habit of walking off, Sam said. Could be a bad practice, maybe a bad game. Could be nothing.
Why tolerate it?
He's by far our best receiver, Sam said. Plus he plays for cheap.
Dude's got some hands, Trey said.
And he can fly, Sly said. Faster than me.
Come on.
Nope. Beats me 4 steps in the 40.
Nino arrived early, too, and after a round of buongiornos, he stretched quickly, then began a long lap around the field.
Why does his ass flinch like that? Rick asked as they watched him jog away.
Sly laughed much too loudly. Sam and Trey broke up, too. Then Sly seized the opportunity to give a quick review of Nino's overactive glutes.
He ain't bad in practice, in shorts, but when he's in full gear and we're hitting, then everything gets tight, especially the muscles that run up his rear cheeks. Nino loves to hit, and sometimes he almost forgets to snap the ball because he's thinking so hard about hitting the nose guard. And when he's poised to hit, all bent over like that, then the glutes start quivering. And when you touch him, he damn near jumps out of his skin.
Perhaps we can run the shotgun, Rick said, and they laughed even harder.
Sure, said Trey. But Nino's not too accurate. You'll be chasing the ball all over the field.
We've tried it, Sam said. It's a disaster.
We gotta speed up his snaps, Sly said. Sometimes I'm already in the hole before the quarterback gets the ball. He's chasing me around, I'm looking for the damn ball. Nino's off growling at some poor sucker.
Nino was back, and he brought Fabrizio with him. Rick suggested they work from the shotgun, do a few patterns. His snaps were okay, not too errant, but awfully slow. Other Panthers arrived, and footballs were soon flying around the field as the Italians practiced their punting and passing. Sam walked close to Rick and said,
"Hour and a half before practice and they can't wait to start. Pretty refreshing, huh?
I've never seen it before.
They love the game."
Franco and his small family lived on the top floor of a palazzo overlooking the Piazza della Steccata
in the heart of the city. Everything was old. The worn marble staircase on the way up, the wooden floors, the tastefully cracked plaster walls, the portraits of ancient royals, the vaulted ceilings with lead chandeliers, the oversized leather sofas and chairs. His wife, however, looked remarkably young. She was Antonella, a beautiful dark-haired woman who attracted second looks and outright stares. Even her heavily accented English left Rick wanting to hear more. Their son was Ivano, age 6, and their daughter was Susanna, age 3. The children were allowed to hang around for the first half hour before heading off to bed. A nanny of some sort lurked in the background. Sam's wife, Anna, was also attractive, and as Rick sipped his Prosecco, he devoted his attention to the two ladies. He'd found a quick girlfriend in Florida after fleeing Cleveland, but was content to vanish without a word to her when it was time to leave for Italy. He had seen beautiful women in Parma, but they all spoke a different language. There were no cheerleaders, and he had cursed Arnie many times for that lie. Rick was longing for female companionship, even the accented variety over a cocktail with the wives of friends. But the husband stayed close, and at times, Rick was lost in a world of Italian as the other four laughed at Franco's punchlines. A tiny gray-haired woman in an apron passed through occasionally with a platter of appetizers, cured meats, Parmigiano cheese, olives. Then she disappeared into the narrow kitchen where dinner was being prepared. The surprise was the dinner table, a slab of black marble resting on two massive urns on the patio, a small flower-lined terrace overlooking the center of town. The table was crowded with candles and silver and flowers and fine china and liters of red wine. The night air was clear and still, chilly only when a slight wind blew. From a hidden speaker, an opera could barely be heard. Rick was given the best seat, the one with a clear view of the top of the Duomo. Franco poured generous glasses of red wine, then offered a toast to their new friend.
"A Super Bowl for Parma," he said, almost lustfully, in closing.
"Where am I?" Rick asked himself. Usually in March he was hanging out in Florida, bumming a room off a friend, playing golf, lifting weights, running, trying to stay in shape while Arnie worked the phones in a desperate search for a team in need of an arm. There was always hope. The next call could mean the next contract. The next team could mean the big break. Each spring brought a fresh dream that he'd finally find his place. A team with a great offensive line, a brilliant coordinator, talented receivers, everything. His passes would be on target. Defenses would crumble. The Super Bowl, Pro Bowl, fat contract, endorsements, fame, lots of cheerleaders. It all seemed possible every March. Where am I? The first course, or the antipasto, was thickly sliced cantaloupe covered with thin slices of prosciutto. Franco poured more wine as he explained that this dish was very common throughout the Emilia-Romagna region, something Rick had heard more than once. But, of course, only the best prosciutto comes from Parma. Even Sam rolled his eyes at Rick. After a few hearty bites, Franco asked,
"So, Rick, do you like opera?"
To give an honest hell no would be to insult everyone within 100 miles at least, so Rick played it safe. "We don't listen to a lot of it back home," he said.
"It's very big here," Franco said.
Antonella smiled at Rick as she nibbled on a tiny bit of melon.
"We take you sometime, yes? We have Teatro Reggio, the most beautiful opera house in the world," Franco said.
"Parmesans are crazy about opera," Anna said.
She was sitting next to Rick, with Antonella directly across, and Franco, the judge, at the head of the table.
"And where are you from?"
Rick asked Anna, anxious to change subjects.
"Parma. My uncle was a great baritone."
"Teatro Reggio is more magnificent than La Scala in Milan,"
Franco was announcing to no one in particular, so Sam decided to quibble.
"No way," he said. "La Scala is the greatest."
Franco's eyes widened as if he might attack. The rebuke sent him directly into Italian, and for a moment everyone listened in an uneasy silence. He finally composed himself and said in English,
"When did you go to La Scala?"
"Never," Sam said. "Just saw some photos." Franco laughed loudly as Antonella left for the next course.
"I take you to the opera," Franco said to Rick,
who just smiled and tried to think of something worse.
The next course, the primo piatto, was anolini, a small round pasta stuffed with parmigiano and beef and smothered in porcini mushrooms. Antonella explained that it was a very famous dish from Parma, and her description was in the most beautifully accented English Rick had ever heard. He really didn't care how the pasta tasted. Just keep talking about it. Franco and Sam were discussing opera in English. Anna and Antonella were discussing children in English. Finally, Rick said, "Please, speak Italian. It's much prettier." And they did. Rick savored the food and wine and view. The dome of the cathedral was majestic in its lights, and the center of Parma was alive with traffic and pedestrians. The anolini yielded to the secondo piatto, the main course, a roasted stuffed capon. Franco, several glasses deep into the wine, graphically described a capon as a male chicken who gets castrated. Whack! When only 2 months old.
"Adds to the flavor,"
Antonella said, leaving the impression, at least to Rick, that the rejected parts might actually be in the stuffing. After 2 tentative bites, though, it didn't matter. Testicles or not, the capon was delicious. He ate slowly, very amused at the Italians and their love of conversation at the table. At times they focused on him and wanted to know about his life. Then they would drift back to their musical language and forget about him. Even Sam, from Baltimore and Bucknell, seemed more at ease chatting with the women in Italian. For the first time in his new home, Rick admitted to himself that learning a few words was not a bad idea. In fact, it was a great idea if he had any hope of scoring points with the girls. After the capon, there was cheese and another wine, then dessert and coffee. Rick finally made a graceful departure a few minutes after midnight. He strolled through the night, back to his apartment, and fell asleep on his bed without undressing. Chapter 12. On a beautiful Saturday in April, a perfect spring day in the Po Valley, the bandits from Naples left home at 7 a.m. on a train headed north for the season's opening game. They arrived in Parma just before 2 p.m. Kickoff was at 3 o'clock. The return train would leave at 11:40, and the team would arrive in Naples around 7 a.m. on Sunday, 24 hours after leaving. Once in Parma, the bandits, 30 of them, took a bus to Stadio Lanfranchi and hauled their gear to a cramped dressing room just down the hall from the Panthers. They changed quickly and scattered around the field, stretching and following the usual pre-game rituals. 2 hours before kickoff, all 42 Panthers were in their locker room, most burning nervous energy and anxious to hit someone. Signor Bruncardo surprised them with new game jerseys, black with shiny silver numbers and the word Panthers across the chest. Nino smoked a pre-game cigarette. Franco chatted with Sly and Trey. Pietro, the middle linebacker who was improving by the day, was meditating with his iPod. Matteo scurried around, rubbing muscles, taping ankles, repairing equipment. A typical pre-game, thought Rick. Smaller locker room, smaller players, smaller stakes. But some things about the game were always the same. He was ready to play. Sam addressed the team, offered a few observations, then turned them loose. When Rick stepped onto the field 90 minutes before kickoff, the stands were empty. Sam had predicted a big crowd, maybe 1,000. The weather was great, and the day before, the Gazzetta di Parma ran an impressive story about the Panthers' first game, and especially about their new NFL quarterback. Rick's handsome face, in color, had been splashed across half a page. Signor Bruncardo had pulled some strings and thrown some weight around, according to Sam. Walking onto a field in an NFL stadium, or even one in the Big Ten, was always a nerve-wracking experience. The pre-game jitters were so bad in the locker room that the players fled as soon as they were allowed. Outside, engulfed by enormous decks of seats and thousands of fans and cameras and bands and cheerleaders and the seemingly endless mob of people who somehow had access to the field, players spent the first few moments adjusting to the barely controlled chaos. Walking onto the grass of Stadio Lanfranchi, Rick couldn't help but chuckle at the latest stop in his career. A frat boy limbering up for a flag football game would have been more nervous. After a few minutes of stretching and calisthenics led by Alex Oliveto, Sam gathered the offense on the 5-yard line and began running plays. He and Rick had selected 12 that they would run the entire game, 6 on the ground and 6 in the air. The bandits were notoriously weak in the secondary, not a single American back there. And the year before, the Panthers' quarterback had thrown for 200 yards. Of the 6 running plays, 5 went to Sly. Franco's only touch would be a dive play on short yardage, and only when the game was won. Though he loved to hit, he also had the habit of fumbling. All 6 pass plays went to Fabrizio. After an hour of warm-ups, both teams retreated to their dressing rooms. Sam huddled the Panthers for a rousing speech, and Coach Oliveto pumped them up with a ferocious assault on the city of Naples. Rick didn't understand a word, but the Italians certainly did. They were ready for war. The Bandits' kicker was another ex-soccer player with a big foot, and his opening drive sailed through the end zone. As Rick trotted onto the field for the first series, he tried to remember the last game he started. It was in Toronto, 100 years ago. The homestands were packed now, and the fans knew how to make noise. They waved large hand-painted banners and yelled in unison. Their racket had the Panthers looking for blood. Nino, especially, was out of his mind. They huddled, and Rick called, 26 smash! Nino translated, and they headed for the line. In an I formation, with Franco 4 yards behind him at fullback, and Sly 7 yards deep, Rick quickly scanned the defense and saw nothing that worried him. The smash was a deep handoff to the right side that allowed the tailback flexibility to read the blocking and pick a hole. The Bandits had 5 down linemen and 2 linebackers, both smaller than Rick. Nino's glutes were in full panic, and Rick had long since decided to go with a quick snap, especially on the first drive. He did a quick down, a beat, hands under center, a hard slap because a feather touch sent the center into illegal motion, then
set,
a beat, then
hut.
For a split second, everything moved but the ball. The line fired forward, everyone growling and grunting, and Rick waited. When he finally got the ball, he did a quick pump to freeze the safety, then turned for the handoff. Franco lurched by, hissing at the linebacker he planned to maul. Sly got the ball deep in the backfield, faked toward the line, then cut wide for 6 yards before going out of bounds.
27 smash,
Rick called. Same play, but to the left. Gain of 11, and the fans reacted with whistles and horns. Rick had never heard so much noise from 1,000 fans. Sly ran right, then left, and the offense crossed midfield. It stalled at the Bandits' 40, and with a 3rd and 4, Rick decided to toss one to Fabrizio. Sly was panting and needed a break.
I right flex Z, 64, curl H swing, Rick said in the huddle.
Nino hissed out the translation. A curl to Fabrizio. His linemen were sweating now, and very happy. They were stuffing the ball into the heart of the defense, driving at will. After 6 plays, Rick was almost bored and looking forward to showing off his arm. After all, they weren't paying him 20 grand for nothing. The Bandits guessed right and sent everyone but the 2 safeties. Rick saw it coming and wanted to check off, but he also didn't want to risk a busted play. Audibles were tricky enough in English. He dropped back 3 steps, hurried his pass, and fired a bullet to the spot Fabrizio was supposed to be curling into. A linebacker from the blind side hit Rick hard in the square of his back, and they went down together. The pass was perfect, but for a 10-yarder it had too much velocity. Fabrizio went up, got both hands near it, then took it hard in the chest. The ball shot upward and was an easy interception for the strong side safety. Here we go again, Rick thought as he walked to the sideline. His first pass in Italy was an exact replica of his last one in Cleveland. The crowd was silent. The Bandits were celebrating. Fabrizio was limping to the bench, gasping for breath. Way too hard, Sam said, leaving no doubt about blame. Rick removed his helmet and knelt on the sideline. The quarterback for Naples, a small kid from Bowling Green, completed his first 5 passes and in less than 3 minutes had the Bandits in the end zone. Fabrizio stayed on the bench, pouting and rubbing his chest as though ribs were cracked. The backup wide receiver was a fireman named Claudio, and Claudio caught about 1/2 of his passes in pre-game warm-up and even fewer in practice. The Panthers' 2nd drive began at their 21. 2 handoffs to Sly picked up 15 yards. He was fun to watch from the safety of the backfield. He was quick and made wonderful cuts.
"When do I get the ball?" Franco asked in the huddle.
2nd and 4, so why not?
Take it now, Rick said, and called, 32 dive.
32 dive?
Nino asked in disbelief. Franco cursed him in Italian, and Nino cursed back. And as they broke huddle, half the offense was grumbling about something. Franco took the ball on a quick dive to the right, did not fumble, but instead showed an astounding ability to stay on his feet. A tackle hit him, and he spun loose. A linebacker chopped his knees, but he kept his legs churning. A safety came up fast, and Franco delivered a stiff arm that would have impressed the great Franco Harris. He rumbled on across midfield, bodies bouncing off, a cornerback riding him like a bull, and finally a tackle caught up with the mayhem and slapped his ankles together. Gain of 24 yards. As Franco strutted back to the huddle, he said something to Nino, who of course took full credit for the gain because it all came down to blocking. Fabrizio jogged to the huddle, one of his famous quick recoveries. Rick decided to deal with him immediately. He called a play-action pass with Fabrizio on a post pattern, and it worked beautifully. On first down, the defense collapsed on Sly. The strong safety bit hard, and Fabrizio was by him with ease. The pass was long and soft and perfectly on target, and when Fabrizio took it at a full sprint at the 15, he was all alone. More fireworks, more chants. Rick grabbed a cup of water and enjoyed the racket. He savored his first touchdown pass in 4 years. It felt good, regardless of where he was. By halftime, he had two more touchdowns, and the Panthers were up 28-14. In the locker room, Sam bitched about the penalties. The offense had jumped four times, and he bitched about the zone coverage that had allowed 180 yards passing. Alex Oliveto carped at the defensive line because there was no pass rush, not a single sack. There was a lot of yelling and finger-pointing, and Rick just wanted everyone to relax. A loss to Naples would ruin the season. With only 8 games on the schedule and with Bergamo poised to again run the table, there was no room for a bad day. After 20 minutes of impressive abuse, the Panthers hustled back to the field. Rick felt like he'd suffered through another NFL halftime. The Bandits tied the game with 4 minutes left in the third quarter, and the Parma sideline took on an intensity Rick had not seen in years. He was telling everyone, "Relax, just relax." But he wasn't sure he was understood. The players were looking to him, their great new quarterback. After 3 quarters, it was obvious to both Sam and Rick that they needed more plays. The defense keyed on Sly every snap and double-covered Fabrizio. Sam was getting outfoxed by the very young Naples coach, a former assistant at Ball State. However, the offense was soon to discover a new weapon. On a 3rd and 4, Rick dropped back to pass but saw the left corner coming on a blitz. There was no one to block, so he faked a pass and watched the corner go sailing by. Then he dropped the ball, and for the next 3 seconds, an eternity, worked feverishly to pick it up. When it was retrieved, he had no choice but to run. And run he did, just like in the old days at Davenport South. He scooted around the pile where the linebackers were preoccupied and was immediately in the secondary. The crowd erupted, and Rick Dockery was off to the races. He faked out a corner, cut across to the center, just like Gale Sayers in the old footage, a real broken field ace. The last person he expected help from was Fabrizio, but the kid came through. He managed to roll under the weak side safety just long enough to allow Rick to sprint past, all the way to the promised land. When he crossed the goal line, he flipped the ball to the official and couldn't help but laugh at himself. He had just galloped 72 yards for a touchdown, the longest of his career. Not even in high school had he scored from so far away. At the bench, he was grabbed by his teammates and offered all manner of congratulations, little of which he understood. Sly, through a wide smile, said, "That took forever." 5 minutes later, the running quarterback struck again. Suddenly anxious to show off his moves, he scrambled out of the pocket and seemed ready for another jaunt downfield. The entire secondary broke coverage, and at the last second, 2 feet from the line of scrimmage, Rick zipped a bullet 30 yards across the middle to Fabrizio, who galloped untouched into the end zone. Game over. Trey Colby picked off 2 passes late in the fourth quarter, and the Panthers won 48-28. They gathered at Polipo's for all the beer and pizza they wanted at Senior Bruncardo's expense. The night went long, with bawdy drinking songs and dirty jokes. The Americans, Rick, Sly, Trey, and Sam, sat together at one end of a long table and laughed at the Italians until the laughter was painful. At 1 a.m., Rick emailed his parents. Mom and Dad, had our first game today. Beat Naples Bandits by 3 touchdowns. 18 for